Good afternoon. My name is Meade Treadwell. I'm Lieutenant Governor of Alaska. And today we are going to hold a hearing on the so-called Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, which is going to be on the ballot as ballot measure 4 in November. This is following in a line of hearings that we've already had in Northwest Alaska and Arctic Alaska. And we'll have two hearings in Southeast Alaska this week, one here and one in Ketchikan, and then go back to South Central and Southwest Alaska in the weeks to come. Our agenda for the meeting today and just the whole purpose of the hearings today is to recognize that this is a bill that becomes an act of law without the regular legislative process, without amendments. But there are many things that are laid on the record during the time of legislative hearings that are often important when the law is implemented. For example, there are mechanics of the law, and we'll get that out on the record. There, you will hear people testify for and against the law, and that will be on the record. There will be questions about the intent of the proposers or what may well have been in the voters' minds when they passed the initiative, that will be teased out in these hearings and may be useful later. So not only are these hearings helpful to voters who are going to decide on how to vote on these hearings, but they may be helpful to the government implementing the law if this law does go into effect. Our agenda today is first for me to go through a summary and a sectional analysis of the bill, then to invite the proponents of the bill to speak for it for 10 minutes. An opposition group to the bill will speak against it for 10 minutes. And then we will open it up to you, the public who are legislators, and you can call in to ask questions. There are people here in the hearing room. And then we have experts online, including Michelle Hale from DEC's Division of Water, Charlie Swanton from ADF&G, Kyle Moselle. Kyle, I hope I pronounced your name right, from the Department of Natural Resources. And we also have several others who've said they're online to answer questions, including Jason Bruni, head of the Alaska Miners Association. So with that, let me move forward with the hearing and give you a summary of the proposed bill. If you're here in the hearing room, we have online a copy of the bill itself, a copy of the cost estimate provided by the Office of Management and Budget that we published at the time the bill was circulated for signatures, and there's an Attorney General's letter that talks about a number of constitutional issues with the bill. It was the letter that I was given to decide to put the measure on the ballot, and as you might note from reading that, there are some constitutional issues that could come up after the measure is passed, if it passes. So to go from here, the summary of the proposed bill. This bill would attempt to provide protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon in waters within or flowing into the designated Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserves by requiring legislative approval for certain large-scale metallic sulfide mines. It would require a law finding that the proposed mining operation will not constitute danger to the fishery within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve and would be in addition to other permits and authorizations already required for such mines to operate in the region. To go to a sectional analysis of the bill, the first section of the initiative would add a new statutory provision with three subsections in Alaska Statutes 38.05.142, legislative approval required for certain large-scale mines to Title 38. In addition to permits and authorization otherwise required by law, the legislature must give final authorization for any, quote, large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation located within the watershed of the Bristol Bay's Fisheries Reserve. The Commissioner of Natural Resources would be in charge of adopting regulations under the Administrative Procedures Act to implement the statute, and it defines a large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation as a specific mining proposal to extract metals, including gold and copper, from sulfide-bearing rock, and one that would directly disturb 640 or more acres of land. The other sections of the initiative would add new provisions to the uncodified law of the state, containing 10 specified findings by the people. And the findings would generally provide for recognition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve as a region of statewide significance to sport, commercial, and subsistence fisheries, Alaska's economy, the global fishing economy, and a region of cultural importance to Alaska Natives. The provisions outlined in the initiative do not retroactively take place on or have any effect on existing mining operations throughout the state. Now, just to sum up here, if this initiative is passed by the voters, it becomes effective 90 days after certification. Unlike other legislation, it's not subject to veto and may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date. That's according to the Constitution, Article 11. And although the legislature may amend an initiative at any time after it's enacted, any amendments made during the first 2 years may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or otherwise vitiate the intent. And there have been a number of legal cases on other initiatives that help explain those, set those guidelines. We asked the Department of Natural Resources and others to tell us what the cost estimate of the bill is. And the estimate of the costs, the Department of Natural Resources estimated $70,000, $52,000 of which was in personal services, $14,000 in travel, $4,000 in supplies and materials. The Alaska Legislature estimated $50,000, and their cost estimate is associated with advising agencies in regards to processing public records requests, legislative review, process and hearing documents, and agency regulations review and revisions. The legislature sometimes on a complex issue will hire a number of consultants. They certainly have on gas line legislation and so forth, so their number could actually be higher or lower depending on what kind of advice they seek, and the Department of Natural Resource number could be higher or lower. We did not estimate expenses or find expenses in other agencies per se. It was deemed that the other resource agencies, DEC and Fish and Game, would be able to handle questions from the legislature based on their existing budget. We did say in the Lieutenant Governor's office and the Division of Elections that it's approximately $80,000, a total of $71,000 in the Division of Elections, including the timing to work and process the petitions and to move forward with the referendum or the initiative process, and $9,000 for the share that these hearings are costing our office. So with that, let me invite Anders up to the desk. I don't know if you have a slideshow. Yep, she's got that queued up. And Anders, we're delighted to have you as a witness this morning, this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Hope everybody can hear me okay. Yes, my name is Anders Gustafsson. I'm the Executive Director of the Renewable Resources Coalition and Foundation. We're a nonprofit based here in Alaska that's worked a long time on the Bristol Bay salmon and the pebble mine issue. And we would like to speak today in favor of Ballot Measure 4 to add a layer of protection for the area's wild salmon runs. And we believe that this initiative takes us a step in the right direction in creating another layer of public review that allows a meaningful public input and an opportunity for the state of Alaska to weigh in, as we are a ownership state, and we all get to have a say on how things take place on our lands. And we think that this would be a necessary and a meaningful amendment to be made. I will step through a couple things on a slideshow just to highlight some of our points. First of all, I just want to reiterate that the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve that this bill act, intends to amend was created in 1972 by Jay Hammond. This is a king salmon we caught this summer. Some of these photos are all from the last couple months I've been out in the bay enjoying myself. Anyways, in 1972, when we were developing oil and gas leases on the North Slope, Jay Hammond and several others in the legislature decided that, well, that was all fine and well. We wanted to make sure we had protections in place for our Bristol Bay area and that not all areas of the state were open to exploiting and getting into without some additional review. He was able to create the legislation featured here on the right, very quick, small piece of legislation that created the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. A couple things I just want to highlight on there is that the law's intention was to protect the fishery from non-compatible development, and it was created over 14 years, probably more really, from the initial discovery even of the deposit at the Pebble site. So when they were creating these rules and creating this law, it wasn't even a twinkle in their eye that there would ever be a proposal for one of the world's largest open-pit copper and gold metallic sulfide mines. So in the past, this bill, this initiative has actually been proposed through the Senate as a Senate Bill 152, and I believe Senator French introduced this, and he pointed out that we were following up in the footsteps of giants and basically completing work that they had created and started, but didn't have the foresight to realize what threats would come. So really we were doing the right thing by amending this law and updating it to the current threats. And it also just proves that in the history of Alaska, we have meant to and tried to and intended to protect our Bristol Bay fishery, and we are continuing that work today. This is a map of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve that we made with a little bit more modern technology, just to show you the scope of the region and why we consider it to be an important issue. If you look in the center, you'll see all the mine claims, all of the orange area in the center of the, in the heart of the reserve, I like to call it. That is where the Pebble Mine would be located. That's the deposit in the center and small kind of orange color right in the middle of the, or yellow color in the middle of the orange. There was over 1,000 square miles of adjoining mine claims when Pebble was discovered and hyped to be a large deposit. Other mining companies came in. That's when myself and many others in the region, native villages, native corporations, lodge owners, commercial fishermen all activated to try and educate the state on the threat and what we had to lose, what we stood to lose if there was a major catastrophe or any kind of danger to the fishery from that point. So I just want to follow up with very simple concepts for folks who are listening online, too. Four reasons why we support four. First of all, the reserve produces half of the world's wild salmon supply. Well, a lot of areas in Alaska produce salmon runs, and we have incredible fisheries throughout southeast and south central. Bristol Bay is very unique in that it is a completely wild salmon fishery. And the value of wild salmon, we have proven with our Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute as well as promoting. That's a very important distinguishing factor for Alaska salmon in the global market. And Bristol Bay happens to produce half of that supply. So it's very, very important at a statewide level. People fish Bristol Bay from all over the country and all over the state of Alaska. Large-scale mining like Pebble, we believe, should have to follow the same rules that oil and gas has had to follow since 1972. We don't think that this is an unfair burden to meet. It's not an impossible standard. But unless they can prove that they have done it successfully elsewhere and that the technology that they would like to employ would not affect the fishery, we think that that's fair. Economically, the reserve creates an annual economic impact of over $1.5 billion. That's a number come up by an economist somewhere. I know there's over $500 million just in commercial revenue generated in the state alone. And we think that that is worth protecting as a long-term renewable resource for the state of Alaska and worth an extra level of review before we would put it at risk. And finally, ballot measure four, specific to Bristol Bay watershed. As you know, you cannot create an initiative, or initiative could not create the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. That would be unconstitutional. But since it had already been created by the Alaska State Legislature, it is possible to amend that, that legislation and create this rule. Therefore, we're not trying to legislate or trying to create rules for other mines around the state of Alaska. I think that's very important for people to understand that this is specifically for this region. Just showing some images of activities that have taken place here that I've just been part of in the last few weeks and people from all around the world and the state who have come to participate in them. It's a very, very high-quality fishery. And here's how we believe that this protects salmon. We think the ballot measure for mandates that Alaskans have a say whether the project should be put in the reserve, put the reserve in danger by their elected representation in the legislature. Basically, taking the decision that will be made by agency bureaucrats who are unelected and unaccountable to the voters, they would still have their say through the permitting process, but there would be an additional level of review now that the state would be involved in, and every participant and every resident in the state, by their legislator, would have an input on whether this project would put the fishery at risk. So it really sheds a lot of light on what the entire scope of the project and the threat and what it'll look like, and gives it out to the state of Alaska to be able to review. We think that that's in light of some of the things we've lost with coastal zone management disappearing and other opportunities for public input being diminished, we think that this is, in some small way, a good way of pushing some of that public process back into this, specifically for Bristol Bay. And also it sets the standard of no danger. We've talked about this in the past, and danger is defined to me as risk, not harm. That's a different standard. Harm would be actually killing fish. Danger is putting the fish at risk, and not just one single fish, but the fishery as a whole. So you're looking at it a large-scale model. This would have to be proven in hearings similar to this in front of the same bodies, probably the same room, where experts and scientists would be able to be giving public testimony, and everyone would be able to hear what people perceive those risks to be and what those how those risks would be mitigated or avoided. And we think that that's an important public process. And like I said before about the specific region, why we think that's important, I just want to finish. I know we have a limited amount of time, and I want to give fair time to both sides. But Ted Stevens, I think, said it best when he said, "I'm not opposed to mining, but this is the wrong mine for the wrong place." And then I featured a photo here of Frying Pan Lake, which is ground zero for Pebble Mine. The mine would be built in the lower right-hand corner of the screen, and original proposals called for damming this entire lake and valley up to create tailings impoundments at that headwaters position, which is the headwaters of both the Nooshigak and the Kwajalleq River, the two most productive salmon rivers in Bristol Bay. So in summary, we would like to support Ballot Measure 4 and ask that residents vote for Ballot Measure 4 to add another layer of public process through their legislature to protect the salmon of Bristol Bay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm now going to invite the opposition to make a statement on this, and you'll be available for questions. We'll invite you up after the opposition statement to be part of questions and answers. Alicia, I think you're on.
I am.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Certainly. So my name is Alicia Amberg. I'm with the Alaska Miners Association, and I'd like to speak a little bit today about our position on Ballot Measure 4. So Ballot Measure 4, the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, stands to politicize the permitting process by requiring legislative approval in addition to the existing National Environmental Policy Act process and other permitting requirements that would take place at a mine in the Bristol Bay region. So the problem with citizen initiatives, we think, is that they have too many unknowns, and this is no exception. It brings uncertainty to the Alaska's investment climate and sets a bad precedent that can easily creep into other venues in Alaska. It will certainly pose additional burden to the legislature and permitting agencies, and without any added benefit to our environment. Above all this, the initiative is very likely unconstitutional. The constitutionality of the existing Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve has never been tested in courts. Our Constitution prohibits special and local legislations, and most importantly, the separation of powers has had serious concerns expressed by at least one Alaska Supreme Court justice. So it's important to note that Ballot Measure 4 will not stop Pebble. Should the Pebble project submit a mine plan and receive the multitude of permits such a project like that would need, then denial by the legislature, in our opinion, at that point would be purely political. We think that Alaska's permitting process should be scientific and not political, and that's why AMA is supporting the vote no position on Ballot Measure 4. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to invite you to stay on the line, Alicia, and Anders, invite you up to a microphone if you'd like to join us here. Before we go to other testimony, I guess I just have a number of questions that are occasioned by your comments that I'd like to get on the record per se. One is, you make the statement that this law essentially offers the same rules as oil and gas has had in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve since 1972. Mm-hmm. And can you explain when is a legislative vote required on an oil and gas development as opposed to when a legislative vote would be required on a mining development, because I'm not sure the law actually triggers at the same time.
I don't know exactly the answer to that, I guess. What we haven't seen in the past is that this law was put into place, and I don't believe that in the history of its existing that any oil and gas lease has tried to go through this standard, as in nobody's applied for and gotten all of their permits for any oil and gas leases within the reserve and then attempted to go to the legislature for its approval.
Okay.
I think that was a safeguard that was put in place, but it just there was maybe no oil reserves there that people were trying to get to. That
right. I don't have a statute in front of me. So could theoretically the state lease oil and gas land and then someone make a discovery and then it goes to the legislature for approval, or when, or would it go to the legislature for approval before leasing?
I don't know the answer to that question, I guess. I would have to consult, but I would assume that it would go after permitting.
I don't know
permitting.
The answer, but given the fact that you've said it's the same, mm-hmm. let's check and make sure it's the same.
That sounds
okay?
Good.
So that we know that, because it's my understanding that the state wouldn't lease until there was an act of the legislature. In this case, the state, in essence, did open the land mm-hmm. for exploration, and we're adding a legislative requirement if the bill passes there. Alicia or Jason, if you have any comment to make on these questions, just chime in. The second question I'd like to kind of get.
Lieutenant Governor, this is Jason Bruni.
Jason, go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to address that question. Indeed, if you look at the legislative history of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, mining was originally included, and there was an amendment put in intentionally to remove mining from the formation of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. So that is the legislative history and the intent of the initial bill.
The initial bill, as I understand it, Jason, too, that was never passed. I believe that was in a draft form, and there was I have a copy of it somewhere on my computer where it shows the existing statute, and then included in that language was comma mineral leases. And at that point, I believe mineral leases were removed, because mineral leases was more vague and included all small mine,
okay.
Where this is more specifically to large, hard-scale metallic sulfide mining, as opposed to plaster mom-and-pop plaster mines.
Okay.
Which
was what I'm going to do is invite both sides to supply anything you would like to supply for the record, but this is some place where it would be good to have a legislative record on this legislation there. And I think it was at least my understanding last time I read it, and I did not come today with the law in front of me, that the legislative trigger happens at the time of leasing rather than at the time of discovery or afterwards. But you know, that would make sense, because some people see as much risk in exploration as they do in offshore oil and gas, as one example. The second question is that in your Section 38, you say the authorization shall take the form of a duly enacted law. Is there, and the question I wanted to ask you for the record is, duly enacted law mean a law that has to pass the House, the Senate, and be signed or vetoed by the governor, or can it be a concurrent resolution or the kind of resolution that sometimes the legislature doesn't send to the governor?
No, it has to be passed and approved by all bodies.
By all three bodies.
Right. That was the intent.
That's the intent. Okay. The third question I have is really the question on final authorization. Okay. And when is final? Is it final after all possible permits are granted? Is it one where we can, I'm thinking of sometimes as a pilot, I contact a control tower, and he'd say, you're clear to land. There's still other things I still need to do before I actually do land. I have to fly in the pattern and so forth. But if there's no other traffic area, could the legislature conceivably pass this law before all permits for the project are granted?
No, it has to be done after all of the permits. I mean, it's written in the initiative is that it's an addition to. So permits would have to be filed for, applied to, and in the process of being approved. I mean, I believe that they could probably start the process, but the final, you know, as final things were being done, that would have to be debated at that point, I guess. But the intent was that it would be a final review after the permitting. And part of the reasoning for that is that we believe that while we have a rigorous permitting process in this state, it would behooves us with the value of this fishery and the importance of it to take a comprehensive look at what those impacts may be to, you know, as opposed to in each individual permit, the cumulative impacts of all of those permits being granted. So it would be difficult for legislature to have a finding and hold public hearings where the Alaskans would be able to evaluate the entire process if all of those permits hadn't been established and clarified for everybody to review. So the intent would be to have that at the end of the permitting process. I like to think of it as a hurdle at the end of the hurdle race. You know, there's all the permits are hurdles they have to get over, but at the very end, then there'd be one very large hurdle that shows that there will be no impact or risk to this fishery by granting all of these permits and the entire scope of the project in general.
Okay. Kyle, are you on from DNR?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
So, Kyle, you oversee large permitting in the state. When all the permits come together, are any of them in sequence? Do any of them require others to be passed? And is there can you project a simple situation where you've got everything bundled up, ready to go, and then you take it to the legislature, or are there some permits required in sequence where if a final authorization wasn't in place, they couldn't move forward to get another permit? Can this work in the linear fashion that has been proposed here?
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking of that same question as I was hearing the discussion. Permits are required and reviewed and issued based on discrete jurisdictional authority that's granted to each regulatory agency. And so permits are discrete in the sense that they authorize an activity based on a defined legal authority. And so a mining project, a large-scale hard rock metallic sulfide mining operation, is going to require numerous individual permits before the first shovel can work on the ground. But there are some major permits, like the state's approval for a plan of operations, and with that plan of operations comes a reclamation plan and the financial assurances. So that plan of operations, I would say, would be kind of the umbrella approval that all other activities are described under. And but when you get down to, you know, the minute activities that require maybe local permits and that stuff, it's kind of hard to define that end point where all authorizations required by federal, state, and local laws have been gathered. Because often at that point, there's already been ground broken at the site because they've got the approvals for some of the activities, all the approvals they need for some of the activities to begin.
So
I'm not sure if that answered it or not. But
so let's take a hypothetical situation, but let's suppose have the large mine plan approved, you've got the EIS approved, you go through the legislative process and have it, and then it's discovered or someone says, well, wait a second, you'd need a de minimis hazardous waste issue to haul out some of these, you know, the used dynamite containers or something along those lines. If that permit's not already approved, is it okay to have a legislative vote on this or not?
You know, I don't know if I could speak specifically to that hypothetical situation.
Right.
I mean, obviously there's lots of hypothetical ways this could all play out in the
right.
future. I guess I can really just speak to the fact that the intent is to have this review. And I think it's important to understand that this would have to be proposed. The bill would have to be brought to the legislature. So they could also, I guess, at some point possibly choose when to bring that proposal to the legislature. Because, it would have to be a duly enacted law. So it would have to be created, and that's going to take some time. So I'm assuming that some of these things will be happening tangentially, as the permitting process is going forward. But according to the legislation, a final decision wouldn't be able to be rendered until all those permits have been met. Because that's how I read the initiative, is that it has to be in addition to all permits that have been met.
Okay, so I guess the question is then, and we asked this the other day, and I wasn't looking in the eye. What I'm trying to figure out here is, for example, sometimes a dig begins. I mean, I live next door to a construction site right now where the dig began, and oh my gosh, they found groundwater in a place they hadn't expected to find groundwater. And construction stopped. Well, they went and got a separate permit and redid some stormwater drainage issues and so forth, and then after they'd done that for a month, then they went back to their original plan. And that may happen if you dig a big hole for a mine. Does that require the legislature to come back and approve again?
And we discussed that, and I think the intent was to not have that be, where it goes back again if something has changed. The project, that would be an amendment, and there's as I've been advised, a general rule of reasonableness. And this is a legal terminology that I've been explained to. Again, I'm not a lawyer, for clarification, but at the point when a project is fully and finally defined, how big, where it is, that's when the legislative approval would begin to take place.
Okay.
But there's a standard there of reasonableness, so, that would have to be evaluated and decided probably in the judicial department of, is that a big enough impact? Are they going to go back through and take and propose to have a small underground mine and then say, okay, we got all these standards, and then come back and say, actually, we want to cave it in and do an open pit mine, something that would be very large and change. The intent is that that would probably trigger an additional review because the scope of the project would be fundamentally changed. If they're saying, this road needs a different subgrade to it, and they need a de minimis permit for changing that, that would not be the intent to be triggering it. I mean, I guess it'd have to be, again, that rule of reasonableness that whatever this change or addition or revision of what permit, at how severe is it, or how big is it? Because some of those reviews could be major, and some could be very, very small and insignificant, and that would be decided upon, in a judicial sense, what's considered reasonable.
So if the operator and the Department of Natural Resources went forward and said, we considered this permit to allow mitigation techniques or permit to allow some sort of change in waste stream or something like that to be de minimis, and a citizen decided it was not de minimis and wanted to stop the mine, then they could sue?
They would be able to bring that point up. I assume they would be able to probably sue on that permit standard alone without this initiative having any point in that. I think that would be available for them to sue just on that permit alone being revised. It would be my understanding.
Okay.
Maybe our DNR folks could tell us about that.
Okay.
Lieutenant Governor, this is Jason Bruni.
Jason, go ahead.
I would like to add, just in line with this conversation, that because it will be an act of the legislature, this initiative would then, once that bill, if passed, would be subject to the referendum process that we saw with Ballot Measure 1 and SB 21 this past session and this past election, and subsequently adding a significant amount of further uncertainty and unpredictability to a process that you charge your legislature with doing something, they pass it, let's say they go in support of it, a referendum at that point could be put forward, is my understanding, that would then nullify that action one way or the other.
So in other words,
apply to every law we create in this country.
That does. So
it's irrelevant to this specific one. That's for all laws would be, or any referendum would be able to be.
Okay. There is a timing issue, though. Let's suppose that a mine was approved, and a DNR had gone through the process. The legislature didn't meet till the following January, so that may be a six-month delay. The legislature decides, and it may well be a mine that's not the one that we hear about a lot on the airwaves, okay?
What is that?
involving small rocks. But, and then at that point, you've got this subject to the legislature, and then 30 days it can be a referendum that can then hold off the referendums of the next statewide election, which could be 2 years away.
Right.
So you're possibly building in a three-year delay in the permitting process.
And I would say it's absolutely germane to this, Anders.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, I just get that on the record. Your understanding is that that's subject to any law, and that's that.
Yeah, I mean, referendums can be pulled. You can file a referendum on any law that's passed in the legislature, regardless of whether it's a resource law or anything. I think that's just common knowledge.
Okay.
And my point was just to say that the level of unpredictability that this adds is unacceptable from our perspective.
And to that note, then the level of unpredictability of a large mine going into this fishery would also be unacceptable to us, and we would consider that to be of value and importance, and I wouldn't care how long it takes, because this fishery should be around forever, and if it adds a few months, so be it.
And then I guess the last question I have for you is, let us suppose that the legislature finds that a large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation will not constitute danger to the fishery within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserves, okay? And the legislature reads the fishery as being, something historical where we've seen catch limits go, or, you know, catches go like this, and, you know, it's a fairly constant. Is there an opportunity for a third-party lawsuit if somebody doesn't like the way the legislature makes that finding?
Well, I assume that any legislative finding can be challenged at some level,
sure.
As far as I understand. And again, that finding is really important. The finding of danger would allow people to bring up a whole host of experts. So this is going to be an objective decision made by a body based on testimony, is just like you hear in any law, in any case, by experts determining whether there's a danger. So it would be scientific experts brought forth from all sides of the argument, and it would be allowed to be vetted and discussed in public.
Okay. And do you have any comment on what the opponents have said, either on the special local legislation not being tested or the separation of powers issue that they brought up?
I don't have anything on the kind of being tested, but I do know, and you had the paperwork out here, the
sure.
Supreme Court's decision where it is ordered that this initiative would not make an appropriation of state assets, which was something they contended in the court case. It would not enact local or special legislation, a violation of Article 11 of the Section 7 of the Alaska Constitution. I'm just reading what was given to us by the Lieutenant Governor. And they declined to adjoin, which are that separate. Then it would probably give a written opinion at a future date explaining the reasons for the result. And that's very common of the Supreme Court. They allow things to go to be voted on to see if it passes or not, and then to decide whether they would look into some of the issues further.
Okay.
And the separation of powers, I believe, has been dropped in that argument in the Supreme Court. Again, I'm not the attorney on that matter, but I could find out more details on that.
Okay. Or it may be a timing issue.
Mm-hmm.
Jason or Alicia, do you want to say anything more on those two issues before we open up to regular testimony?
Nothing from me.
Okay.
Nope.
Anders, one other thing.
I just wanted to add one more thing. Sorry, since you gave me the opportunity to rebut anything I'd heard. One thing I've heard from Alicia was that it would create uncertainty and creep, and I just wanted to point out that this has been in place since 1972 for oil and gas, and we've seen the permitting and construction and the development of the Alaska pipeline and oil all over the state in light of this. So the creep argument to me is very much something you very typically hear when in any resource argument from pro-development sides. There's always concern about creep of any laws or things happening here. Well, then it could happen over here or over here. But here, in this case, we actually have proof that it's been here for 40 years and not crept anywhere. So I think that's important for people in the public to understand. And the burden to the legislature was another argument, and I still, to my previous point, isn't Bristol Bay worth reviewing? I mean, isn't that important enough for us that we should not consider that a burden to make sure that it's healthy?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor, where should I send the legislative history? I have it here before me, and the CS for the initial bill specifically removes mining from it, so the 40 years that Anders is referencing is not germane here. I'm happy to send it in wherever you ask me to send it.
Sure. You can send it to lt.governor@alaska.gov, and we'll put it on the website. And I think, April, if you can also get this initial Supreme Court decision on the website. I know we talked about that the other day. Jason, thank you. By the way, if you got the bill in front of you, what is the requirement? When is the legislative requirement on oil and gas? Is it at the time of leasing or the time of exploration or production?
I'll read you what it says. It does not say that I see that, Lieutenant Governor, within the bill specifically. It's a short bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. You're welcome to stay here, Anders, and let's move on and invite speakers. Is there anyone present here who would like to testify for or against the bill or ask questions of the experts online, proponents and opponents? Seeing none in the hearing room, Petlin Nolan, you're in Dillingham, and I invite you to testify.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Petlin Nolan calling from Dillingham, Alaska. I'm a current student of political and environmental studies of UAA and UAF. I'm calling in support of the Bristol Bay Initiative. I worked on the Clean Water Initiative back in 2008, canvassing, and we've been fighting this for a long time. I'm calling on behalf of my family here in Dillingham, my community, Dillingham, my region, and my state, and ultimately the world, being that we provide over half the world's wild salmon. When talking about mining and oil, it's important to understand that oil and mining are different. You know, Alaska has always been an oil state. It's one of the third leg on the tripod of our economy here in the state. But in mining, what you leave behind is forever. Oil, it'll biodegrade in 30 to 50 years. However, in mining, it's forever. And that's something that the state of Alaska will have to pay for when Northern Dynasty, the pretend company behind Hunter Dickinson, which is based in Canada, declares the Northern Dynasty goes bankrupt, Hunter Dickinson is safe in Canada, and we got a big hole in the ground, and Alaskans will have to pay for this cleanup forever in perpetuity. Another thing is the Northern Dynasty applied for 35 billion gallons of water a year, and that's good, clean water from my trees and wells. You know, California is in a drought right now. People are dying for water, and we got clean water, and this is water that we could send to them instead of, you know, poisoning it. Our global fisheries is crashing. You know, I'm a local fisherman here. I've been a fisherman my whole life. So is my father and my grandfather. We live on fish. It's who we are. It's in our DNA. You know, deoxyribonucleic acid. It's in our adamantine cytosine guanine. We're sports fishermen too. You know, and we're also, you know, commercial fishermen. It's our livelihood. Just calling in support, and I hope to have the support of Alaskans and keep Alaska salmon strong. And that's all I have. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Do you have any questions for either the proponent, opponent, or the government officials online?
No, I'm good. I just hope that we can pass this initiative, and a lot of our students can go ahead and study mechanical electrical engineering instead of political and environmental science.
Well, good luck with you in your career and theirs. By the way, we will be having a hearing on this issue in Dillingham on October 2nd, and look forward to meeting you then if you're in town.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate your time, and hope to have your support. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify on this issue? Hearing none. I'd be willing to draw the hearing to the close, but I'm going to ask both the proponents and the opponents if they have anything else they'd like to say.
Yeah, there was one point I just thought of as we were sitting here, and it was relevant to the question that was brought up about the separation of powers argument. I just wanted to point out that the Pebble Partnership, in their lawsuit against this initiative to keep it off of the ballot, had made this point, and during the litigation, they dropped that portion of their lawsuit in the Supreme Court for removing this. So if they had pulled it out of their court case, I don't understand why that would be such a good argument against this initiative if they decided to pull it out of their own case.
Jason, do you want to answer that? I've got an answer that's mechanical, not arguing one side or the other. But, Jason, you go ahead, or Alicia.
I don't work for the Pebble Partnership, so I can't address that.
Okay, and I guess all I can say is that when I, as Lieutenant Governor, put an initiative on the ballot, there are several kind of constitutional qualifiers. It needs to be in the proper form. It needs to be not local special or appropriations legislation. And it needs to be in conformance with governing law that may have been set by previous court cases. Then the Supreme Court generally defers and says you can, if it meets those initial hurdles, then it can go on the ballot and somebody can sue about its constitutionality later. And there are some issues that tend to be better issues brought up later, and I believe separation of powers is one of them because we haven't been very clear. And, in fact, separation of powers was one of those arguments where had Coastal Zone passed, I think we were expecting some lawsuits on that one later on on that. So the Attorney General's opinion, which is available here, talks about several constitutional issues that are likely not to disqualify it from the ballot because there hasn't been governing law on this.
Okay.
And I guess I would ask you philosophically on the separation of powers issue, and I'm, again, not arguing for your legislation or against it. We have a legislature that writes laws, and that's the legislative branch, and then it gives the power to execute those laws to the executive branch. And the executive branch is told, go off and have a scientific standard on water quality, as an example. And if it meets the scientific standard, fine. If not, you don't give a permit. And, you know, they've set the standards based on water quality. Now, you know, DEC still has that power to set that permit. And I guess what you've said is that those permits are not effective in this law, if this law applies, unless there's yet one more political decision, which could be itself a political decision, not necessarily a scientific or objective decision. And so do you understand where the separation of powers argument comes from, and how do you answer that?
It's very confusing, and I don't know if anybody else is having a hard time following it all, but
sure.
I've had a hard time figuring that whole thing out as well, just because it's in the weeds a bit of all of this. For most people understand the separation of powers.
Yeah. It comes up anytime Congress wants to run things,
right?
As opposed to tell the executive branch how to run things.
Right. Well, they're always struggling for power, I suppose.
Sure.
So I guess I'm not sure if I have a clear answer for you on that. I mean, the intent, in my understanding, is not to muddle that issue, but to put it out in the public in a general sense by getting it into the legislative body, and then I guess wouldn't the administrative then also have a say in a duly enacted law that they would be able to then veto or shut down that law anyways? I understand why there's the separation, I guess. And
well, maybe a different way to put it is that presumably you and I can each get a driver's license if we go down there and pass the test, okay? We, in essence, get a permit to drive on the roads. But what you're saying here is that for a certain class of permit applicant, passing the test is not good enough. The legislature also has to act on you in the first, in the final, as well as in the beginning. And so that's where the separation of powers, usually that's delegated to the executive branch to make the decisions based on a standard. So that's, I'm not questioning. And obviously, this would be questioned later on in a hearing, in a litigation sense.
Court
sense.
Would decide this.
But I'm just wondering, had you addressed that in your own thinking as a sponsor?
Not specifically. I don't think that in my the sponsors, I'm not personally with sponsor, but speaking on behalf of it, I doubt sponsors had gone so far as to debate that, you know, internally. Again, that would have been decided in the courts and been dropped by the opponents of it. So, you know,
okay.
We'll have to wait to find out what the Supreme Court would ever say in the future. It's a hypothetical.
Got it. Okay.
And, Lieutenant Governor, I had one final comment.
Go ahead, Jason.
Just to address the comment that was made by the individual who gave public testimony, the state of Alaska has rigorous financial assurance and bonding requirements for any mining project that is constructed in the state. So to think that any company, be it a Canadian or an American or any company, would be able to just up and leave without cleaning things up is not accurate. The Department of Natural Resources enforces those requirements and reviews them on an ongoing regular basis. And just to be clear, a yes vote on this initiative is not going to stop Pebble. What it's going to do is effectively tell the rest of the world that Alaska does not support a stable, transparent, and objective process to evaluate resource projects, and we will be putting our permit decisions, making our permitting decisions by politics rather than science, and that's a dangerous precedent. With that, Lieutenant Governor, thank you for holding the hearing.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor, this is Kyle Mozell with Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Can I have just
Kyle,
a second?
Kyle, let me recognize you.
Sure. So, again, Kyle Mozell, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. On the issue of financial assurances, as I briefly mentioned, the financial assurances, which is that the cost of reclaiming the area post-mining, those get approved as part of the plan of operations and the reclamation plan. And let me just read a statute here, because it might also get back to the question that was raised earlier about how that permitting process is completed. And just this applies to just the state permitting, but Alaska Statute 27.05.010B reads, the department, meaning Department of Natural Resources, is the lead agency for all matters related to the exploration, development, and management of mining, and in its capacity as lead agency, shall coordinate all regulatory matters concerning mineral resource exploration, development, mining, and associated activities before a state agency takes action that may directly or indirectly affect the exploration, development, or management of mineral resources. The agency shall consult with and draw upon the mining expertise of the department, meaning Department of Natural Resources. That's the statute that both contributes to large mine permit coordination, which I do, but it also means that these other associated state permits for mining activities are really pooled, and that's where I said earlier that plan of operations, which includes the reclamation plan and financial assurances, is kind of the umbrella approval from Department of Natural Resources, Mining, Land, and Water, mining section, that all the other kind of state authorizations for that mining activity are within. But jurisdictionally and statutorily, they're all individual authorizations that are applied for, reviewed, and issued or denied based on their own jurisdictional authorities, which are divided between usually DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. So hopefully that gives a little bit better picture about the state side of the permitting. It does not speak to local or municipal or borough authorizations that might be required, or federal processes. Then just real quick, reclamation. What that means is returning the site or placing the site in a stable condition or stable state compatible with future uses. that reclamation of a mining activity is required to be described in the reclamation plan before the mining activity or the disturbance of more than 5 acres can occur. And then the financial assurances is the costs associated with carrying out that reclamation plan. And so the approved reclamation plan is the what and how, and the financial assurances is the costs associated with implementing that plan. The state then requires the mining company to provide one of the approved financial assurance mechanisms up front before the activity is allowed to begin, the mining activity is allowed to begin, so that the state is holding either one of the approved mechanisms is a surety bond or a letter of credit or cash or gold. All of those are approvable means of providing financial assurances to the state. Once the state has one of those mechanisms at that approved financial assurance level in hand, that's when the plan of operations, reclamation plan, and financial assurances package is all approved, and then the mining company can move forward with the activity, provided they have all their local, state, and federal permits in hand. That financial assurance is there so that if the company is unable to implement their reclamation plan as approved, then the state can call or the state can use that financial assurance to implement that plan if the company is insolvent or bankrupt or otherwise unavailable to do it themselves. That's what avoids the situation where the public is burdened with those costs.
Thank you for that explanation, both of you. And I guess the question that I have, do you want to say something on reclamation?
I do, right. Do you want all those comments?
Okay. Section B of the bill in Section 1 says the commissioner may adopt regulations to implement this section. Do you see yourself needing to define final authorization or the timeline here on the way that this bill is written, if this bill passes, okay, how will DNR give guidance to somebody applying to go mining in this region in terms of the timing? Because what you're telling me is yes, before there's a disturbance, you need to have the financial restoration money or the bond in place or that capability in the balance sheet or however you do it. But at the same time, when we talk about the smaller permits and some of the things that come up during operations and so forth, would you be trying to define what leads to a final authorization, even though it may not mean every permit? Or do you read this as saying any possible permit in the project has to be permitted before you can even take this to the legislature?
Are you asking me that?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, the answer I have for that is I don't know. I'm not sure what would be required by this initiative if it became law. With respect to that question, I'm just not sure.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a couple comments on some of the statements that he had made. Thank you, Kyle, for all that information. I think that's helpful for folks to understand. I know we talked about this in the Barrow hearing as well, but I just wanted to highlight a couple points. When he was talking about, and you said restoration, Senator Governor, but it meant he said reclamation, and reclamation is very different than restoration, as he pointed out, and the bonds are made for reclamation. A reclamation standard is for the site to be compatible for human use. Not for fish use, animal use, or other things. So there's a standard there that I heard him say in the last meeting that it was human use, and that the reclamation bonds are just to get it back to that level. And I think that the public has seen in the past across our country examples where this has been woefully inadequate, and we've ended up with Superfund sites all over this country where people having to maintain and the public is having to fork over to maintain some of these very, very large sites that the companies went bankrupt and left, and eventually enough companies went bankrupt inside of that shell that the ultimate people on the hook are the state. And in an instance like Pebble, for instance, it's on state land and state leases. The state would ultimately be the party responsible for maintaining this. And in this case, they're proposing maintenance in perpetuity. So how do you post a reclamation bond for a project that never ends? How do you reclaim something that will be there forever? How do you get it suitable for human use if you're building the world's largest earthen dam to hold back toxic tailings? It just doesn't quite make sense. And I've seen bonds put up, and I've seen DNR post the amounts of bonds for different projects, and some seem a little higher than others. And even the one in Rock Creek in Nome was one that popped out to me. It was about an $8 or $9 million bond. Well, that mine went belly up in a couple of months, and I highly doubt that that's going to be near enough at cost levels up in an operation as far north and remote as Nome to even do much good at all. So we're a little concerned on that front, on the bonding, whether the value is good enough and whether it goes long-term into the future for something that's going to be maintained for perpetuity. How do you even do that? Those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Well, Kyle, thank you. Thank you for all of you who participated in today's hearing. I want to invite you to join us as we look at this issue. As the legislature is required, we have two hearings on each of the initiatives in each of the four judicial districts of the state. So having completed today's hearing here in Juneau, we have five left to go. And we'll be in Ketchikan on September 18th from 4 to 6 at the Borough Assembly Chambers. That's Thursday. Next Monday, we'll be in Kodiak from 1 to 3 at the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chambers. Wednesday next week, we'll be in Anchorage at the Dena'ina Center from 4 to 6. The following Tuesday, we'll be in Fairbanks on September 30th from 1 to 3 in the Assembly Chambers. And finally, October 2nd. In Dillingham from 12 to 2. I want to thank you all for your participation today. And any comments that you'd like be included on the public record in a written form, send them to us at lt.governor@alaska.gov, and we will include that on the record of the hearing. Thank you all very much, and we are adjourned.